The 2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 121, An Uncomfortable Connection, Brian David Mitchell and the Mormon Prophetic Tradition. Papers presented by John Charles Duffy and Hugo Elias, with a response by Rod Decker.
Hello? Oh, good. Fine. Hi, I'd like to get everyone to come to quiet and we'll get this started. I've never done this before, so bear with me. This is Section 121, An Uncomfortable Connection, Brian David Mitchell and the Mormon Prophetic Tradition. If you're not in the right section, we might want to change right away. I'd like to remind everyone that we do need to have admission to sessions is by name and ticket only, so if you don't have that, you need to go and get it. We have three speakers today, and the first will be John Charles Duffy. He has a bachelor's degree from BYU in English, a master's from the University of Utah in English, treasurer for the Association for Mormon Letters. He's one of the co-founders of Mormons for Equality and Social Justice. He's published articles in Dialogue, Sunstone, and other venues, and he's preparing to do a doctorate for religious studies. And our next speaker will be Hugo Olez. He was born in Argentina. He obtained a degree in Spanish and Literature from the Universidad Nacional de La Plata and a master's in Spanish from Brigham Young University. His articles have appeared in Dialogue and Sunstone, and he currently writes for the news sections for Sunstone Magazine and lives in Salt Lake City. Our final speaker will be Rod Decker, a veteran reporter with KUTV News Channel 2. Amazingly, we have the least amount of information on Rod, but I think we all know him. Hopefully, we will have plenty of time at the end for questions and answers, and we'll move right along.
As I get started, I have a handout that I'm going to pass out. There are about 40 copies, so there might be enough for everyone to have one, but we'll have to see. We may have to do this in Law of Consecration style, where you share. What I'm about to read is a much abridged version of a longer paper, which hopefully you will have the chance to read soon in published form. On the day following Brian David Mitchell's arrest on suspicion of kidnapping Elizabeth Smart, LDS Public Affairs emphatically denied that Mitchell was Mormon. Neither Brian David Mitchell nor his wife, Wanda Eileen Mitchell, are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or are affiliated with it in any way, an official church statement declared. The statement conceded that Mitchell and his wife are former church members, but hastened to add that they had been excommunicated for promoting bizarre teachings and lifestyle far afield from the principles and doctrines of the church. Church officials admitted to the New York Times that media coverage surrounding Mitchell's arrest had put them on the defensive. News stories around the globe linked Mitchell to LDS teachings about polygamy and personal revelation. There was the suggestion, at times the outright assertion, that this horrible incident was a product of Mormonism. Like it or not, one online commentator wrote, the truth of the matter is that within the Mormon doctrines lie evil seeds waiting to germinate in deluded specimens like Brian David Mitchell. In response to accusations like this, Latter-day Saints have moved in various ways to distance themselves from Mitchell. The church statement I just quoted is one example of how the saints have sought to minimize Mitchell's Mormon connection. Mitchell has been dismissed as delusional, deranged, mentally ill, perhaps even a conscious fraud. Mitchell may be mentally ill. He may have acted with conscious intent to deceive. But Mitchell is also devoutly, all too devoutly, religious. And the religious worldview to which he subscribes is rooted in Mormonism. Mitchell's beliefs may be far afield of what the majority of today's saints profess, but there are possibly thousands of members and former members of the church who would find that in many ways Mitchell's beliefs coincide with their own. To understand Mitchell, we need to first understand something about the history and internal dynamics of the LDS community. During the 20th century, Mormonism transformed itself from a radical separatist movement into a more mainstream religion, still distinctive, but accommodationist, more in line with conservative American values. Not weird, as Gordon B. Hinckley has famously said. Accommodation has required that certain traits or tendencies prominent in 19th century Mormonism be de-emphasized, attenuated, or altogether suppressed. Older ways of thinking have not disappeared, however, especially in the Mormon corridor, where they are passed from generation to generation in families and communities whose roots go back to 19th century Mormonism. Accommodation has shifted people who subscribe to these older ways of thinking to the margins of the LDS community. But people in this position are likely to have a strong awareness of their connection to past Mormon tradition and therefore a strong sense of their legitimacy. Accommodation-resistant subcultures on the margins of Mormonism are the key to understanding Mitchell's Mormon connection. Mitchell emerges from this Mormon fringe. His so-called bizarre beliefs are in fact descended from attitudes once mainstream in Mormonism, but later pushed to the margins by accommodation. Mitchell demonstrates four tendencies current among accommodation-resistant Latter-day Saints. 1, nostalgia for everyday access to the supernatural. 2, allegiance to alternative teachings about health. 3, ultra-conservative politics. And 4, a strong impulse to separate from the world. You may have noticed I'm saying nothing here about polygamy, though Hugo will be touching on that a little bit. I'm looking at entirely different issues. Let me discuss each of those four traits in turn. 1, nostalgia for the supernatural. 19th century Mormons inhabited a conceptual world where supernatural phenomena were unsurprising. They expected and witnessed miraculous healings, outpourings of spiritual gifts, such as tongues or prophecy, visitations by angelic or demonic beings. Such events were held up as a sign that the LDS movement was indeed the Lord's work. The absence of miracles in other faith communities was regarded as a sign of apostasy. Certainly, accounts of the miraculous and the supernatural survive into contemporary Mormonism, but they are less prominent, less expected than they once were. Members are often cautioned not to expect dramatic spiritual manifestations, and those who do have them are advised that these experiences are sacred and therefore should not be spoken of. As a result, LDS discourse is now dominated by what might be called a routinized spirituality, in which encounters with the spiritual realm take the form of peaceful feelings or general impressions rather than audible voices or visitations from the spirit world. The shift to a routinized spirituality has produced an undercurrent of nostalgia for the days when the supernatural was closer at hand. The popularity of Betty Eady's Embrace by the Light, published in 1992 by an independent LDS press before going on to become a national bestseller, demonstrates the fascination that many saints continue to have for accounts of the supernatural despite their marginalization in official LDS discourse. Though Eady was criticized by many Latter-day Saints as well, it was clear that she had struck a nerve, at least within a segment of the LDS community. Mitchell shares the nostalgia for the supernatural that drew so many other saints to Eady's book at a time when experiences like hers had virtually dropped out of official discourse. Mitchell's revelations cite Embraced by the Light as a true testament of Christ. During the early 1990s, Mitchell and his third wife, Wanda Barzee, prayed for hours at a stretch, apparently in search of dramatic spiritual manifestations of their own. Angelic visitations and revelations followed. Mitchell holds up the LDS mainstream's routinized spirituality as a sign of apostasy. In Mitchell's The Book of Emmanuel, the Lord laments that visions, prophecy, and miracles are no longer common among the saints. Where are the visitations and miracles that marked the work of the Lord's servants in ages past? Mitchell asks the church. It was the same question that early Mormonism had posed to sectarian Christianity. 2, alternative teachings about health. Throughout the 19th century, church leaders promoted faith, herbs, and mild food as the appropriate response to disease. Consulting a doctor was regarded as a sign of weak faith. Though the church eventually endorsed conventional medicine, the older anti-medical tradition endured. As a result, by the 1970s and 80s, the saints had a reputation for being susceptible to medical and nutritional quackery. Alarmed health professionals have pointed to a thriving LDS subculture that regards faith in alternative medicine as synonymous with faith in the restored gospel. One representative of this subculture is LDS naturopath C. Samuel West, author of a book titled The Golden 7+1, which West presents as a product of divine inspiration. West holds that the root cause of all pain, disease, and death is trapped proteins in the bloodstream, which can be removed through various techniques, including adopting a vegetarian diet, bouncing on a trampoline, and learning to redirect the body's bioelectric field. West's book contains pages of testimonials from people who have achieved quasi-miraculous cures by using West's techniques. West touts his science as the key to achieving the promises associated with the word of wisdom, and he alleges that the government, the American Medical Association, and pharmaceutical companies are involved in a secret combination to keep West's science from the knowledge of the public. Health missionaries devoted to West's teachings take a vow of poverty and an oath of obedience, surrendering all their property to an Orem-based organization called the International Academy of Lymphology, which assumes responsibility for meeting their financial needs as they promote West's ideas and related products. Mitchell encountered West in 1993, when his wife's stepfather went to West hoping to be cured of cancer. West's ideas coincided with convictions Mitchell already held regarding the virtues of vegetarianism and secret combinations in the government. It appears that Mitchell tried to make a living for a time by selling the Golden 7 Plus 1, and he and Barzee lived briefly with West on two occasions after they became homeless. The Book of Emmanuel praises West as an Elias, raised up to shed far greater light and truth upon my word of wisdom and my laws of health. The Book of Emmanuel also claims that Ezra Taft Benson testified that West and his book were of God. While I have not been able to confirm this, it is not implausible. Benson was a well-known advocate of alternative medicine. Benson, West, and Mitchell all form part of a larger LDS subculture that regards alternative medicine as integral to the fabric of the restored gospel. 3. Ultra-conservative politics. When the church was persecuted for polygamy, it defended itself by professing devotion to the Constitution and decrying federal tyranny. Since then, most saints have assimilated into the American political mainstream, but the older hardline tradition of constitutionalism, coupled with accusations of government tyranny, has survived in an LDS subculture devoted to ultra-conservative politics. During the Cold War, this subculture's most prominent representatives were Ezra Taft Benson and Cleon Skousen. With the collapse of communism at the end of the 1980s, ultra-conservatives transferred their fear of conspiracy from communism to what the John Birch Society called the New World Order. Fears about the global political situation and the specter of federal tyranny produced an apocalyptic climate, no doubt heightened by the opening of the last decade of the millennium. LDS traditions about emergency preparedness and the horrors of the last days helped legitimize ultra-conservative apocalypticism in the eyes of many saints. So did Ezra Taft Benson's position as church president, which allowed devotees to elevate Benson's ultra-conservative politics to the status of prophecy. Though they perceived themselves as followers of the prophet, ultra-conservatives realized that the majority of saints did not share their outlook. This produced a tendency for ultra-conservatives to view themselves as a vanguard within the church. As ultra-conservatives became increasingly alienated from the LDS mainstream, they came to regard the church as being on the road to apostasy. Benson's incapacitation in the early 90s sparked rumors among ultra-conservatives that he was being muzzled by false leaders who wanted to squelch his prophetic warnings. In the early 90s, church leaders moved to check the ultra-conservative surge. The American Study Group, a popular gathering for ultra-conservative saints, folded in 1991 after church leaders cautioned members not to participate. Popular ultra-conservative scriptorian Avraham Gileadi saw his book, The Last Days, pulled from the shelves of Deseret Book, was instructed by church leaders to stop teaching and writing, and was eventually excommunicated. Shortly after the November 92 presidential election, when ultra-conservative LDS candidate Beau Greitz won nearly 50,000 votes in the Mormon corridor, the church launched a house-cleaning campaign. Local leaders were warned to be on the lookout for members who fit a profile that included sympathies with the John Birch Society, meeting in study groups, inordinate preoccupation with food storage or prophecies of the last days, a conviction that church leaders were muzzling President Benson, and interest in the teachings of Gileadi or Greitz. The church's house-cleaning campaign produced a crisis within the ultra-conservative subculture. Some ultra-conservatives, like Gileadi, submitted to church authority. Others went underground, quietly awaiting the day when God would cleanse his apostate church. Some prominent ultra-conservatives became even more radicalized by the church's opposition, leading them to make claims to prophetic or quasi-prophetic authority. Beau Greitz, after resigning from the church in disgust, went on to found a religious white supremacist fraternity led by 12 warrior priests set apart, anointed, and ordained to combat the satanic New World Order. American Study Group founder Sterling Allen, believing himself to be the one mighty and strong, tried to approach the podium during General Conference to warn the church that it was moving toward apostasy. Jim Harmston, excommunicated as part of the house-cleaning campaign, founded the True and Living Church of Jesus Christ of Saints of the Last Days, claiming to have been ordained by Enoch, Noah, Abraham, and Moses. Mitchell took part in the ultra-conservative surge of the 1990s. I submit, in fact, that his transformation into Emmanuel needs to be understood as his own radicalized response to the church's rejection of ultra-conservatism. The Book of Emmanuel is saturated with the apocalyptic outlook typical of LDS ultra-conservatives, including a fear of the New World Order. We know that Mitchell was one of the over 28,000 Utahns who voted for Beau Greitz in 1992. As part of their transition into homelessness, Mitchell and Barzee lived for a time in one of the constitutional covenant communities Greitz founded in Idaho, where patriots could gather to defend themselves against the New World Order. Mitchell is believed to have attended meetings of Sterling Allen's American Study Group. He plainly admired Avraham Gileadi, whose book, The Literary Message of Isaiah, receives divine endorsement in the Book of Emmanuel. Like other ultra-conservatives, Mitchell regards Ezra Taft Benson as the last of the true prophets. The Book of Emmanuel recounts how sometime in the year before Benson's death, Mitchell had a revelation in the Salt Lake Temple, in which the Lord condemned the saints for rejecting President Benson's testimony and denouncing church leaders as wolves who merely pretended to uphold my prophet Ezra while seeking to take the kingdom by force. In response to the church's apostasy, the Lord transferred the keys of priesthood authority that Ezra held into the hands of Mitchell, who would henceforth be known as Emmanuel David Isaiah. Mitchell was led to found a new organization, the True and Living Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in its purified and exalted state. The organization had exactly two members, Mitchell and his wife Barzi, though Mitchell apparently expected to make more converts. Mitchell's understanding of his role in God's plan is derived from Avraham Gileadi's teachings about a Davidic servant, a temporal Messiah who will restore the kingdom of Israel before the second coming. In the last days, Gileadi had taught that the Davidic servant would suffer in the similitude of Christ at the hands of the wicked in a kind of temporal redemptive sacrifice on Israel's behalf. The prophecies from Isaiah that Gileadi believes refer to this suffering Davidic servant are applied to Mitchell himself in the Book of Emmanuel, including a prophecy that Mitchell will be numbered among criminals. While Mitchell has failed to convince anyone except Barzi that he has indeed been called to play the role he claims, there are possibly thousands of Latter-day Saints who believe that the role needs to be filled. 4. Separation from the world. Mitchell's decision to embrace homelessness as a lifestyle may at first seem to be far afield of Mormon tradition, but in fact, Mitchell's homelessness is an extension of Mormon traditions about separating from the world and preaching without purse or script. Like other ultra-conservative Latter-day Saints, Mitchell sought to separate himself from worldly influences to a degree that his more mainstream LDS relatives found extreme. He would walk out of movies, for example, if profanity was used, and there are reports that he padlocked the television, apparently to keep his stepchildren from watching it unsupervised. In the early 90s, Mitchell's desire to separate himself from worldly influences developed into a desire to separate himself from society altogether. Eventually, he and Barzi would sell all their possessions and become homeless hitchhikers, their way of fulfilling the command to depart from Babylon. As Emmanuel, Mitchell panhandled for a living or survived on the largesse of family or friends, thus literally fulfilling the scriptural injunction that the Lord's messengers be without purse or script. It's not clear exactly when Mitchell became convinced that God wanted him to be a prophet to the homeless, but he was no doubt inspired by Rick Joyner's The Final Quest, which is cited in the Book of Emmanuel. Joyner is an evangelical Christian who teaches that the outpouring of revelation which marked the apostolic age must be restored in the last days. The Final Quest is one of Joyner's revelations, an allegorical dream vision depicting the apocalyptic battle between good and evil. At one point in the Final Quest, Joyner is clothed in a mantle of humility, a dirty, ragged cloak, which Joyner says made me look like a homeless person. Joyner is told, however, that this mantle is the highest rank in the kingdom, and that the Lord is closer to the homeless than to kings. Later, standing before God's throne, Joyner meets a man named Angelo, who in life had been a homeless street preacher. Joyner is guilt-stricken to realize that he had once seen Angelo preaching and dismissed him as a religious nut. Angelo then asks Joyner to remember my friends, the homeless. Many will love our Savior if someone will go to them. Mitchell took Angelo's plea to heart. It is rare for an ultra-conservative saint to opt for homelessness. Ultra-conservatives are more likely to practice extreme separatism by becoming survivalists or trying to live the law of consecration. Yet the example of a homeless Baptist calling himself Jesus Elijah Moses, admired among some ultra-conservative saints, provides an analog for understanding Mitchell's transformation. Raised Baptist, the man now known as Jesus Elijah Moses has been calling himself that ever since a 1993 vision in which he ascended into heaven and became one with those three beings. J.E.M., Jem, as he is called by some, refuses to use his legal name, social security number, or signature because he believes that these are the name, number, and mark of the beast foretold in the Book of Revelation. Jem has thus cut himself off from society. Like Mitchell, Jem wears white robes and a beard, has spent time as a homeless wanderer, and believes himself to be the bearer of a prophetic message. In 2000, Jem somehow encountered ultra-conservative Latter-day Saint Sterling Allen online. Alan was fascinated by Jem and forwarded their correspondence to an ultra-conservative LDS Yahoo group, David's Outcasts. Alan and other subscribers to David's Outcasts admire Jem for his uncompromising anti-materialism, self-sacrifice, and integrity. Subscribers have welcomed Jem into their homes as he has wandered the country. Alan opines that Jem has a bona fide mission to interface with the downtrodden of society. Curiously, no one on David's Outcasts has noted the strong parallels between Jesus, Elijah, Moses, and Emmanuel, David, Isaiah. Quickly, let me conclude. Though accommodation has moved contemporary Mormonism towards the mainstream, many saints continue to subscribe to 19th century beliefs and attitudes. This has yielded subcultures within the LDS community composed of people nostalgic for supernatural manifestations, devoted to alternative medicine and ultra-conservative politics, and having unusually strong impulses to separate themselves from the world. This was the kind of Mormonism to which Mitchell subscribed. By the standards of accommodation, Mitchell's Mormonism is indeed bizarre and far afield of contemporary church teaching, but that fact indicates how far Mormonism has shifted from the impulses that first shaped it. Mitchell sought to live by those original impulses, like thousands of other saints whom accommodation has relegated to the margins of Mormonism. Mitchell is not a random nut who just happens to have come out of the woodwork when he did. At the same time that Mitchell was turning into Emmanuel, LDS ultra-conservatives with beliefs similar to Mitchell's were becoming similarly radicalized in response to upheavals in global politics and increasing alienation from the church. Unlike other radicalized ultra-conservatives, Mitchell seems to have been driving a car with no brakes. His behavior became steadily more extreme until it surpassed anything his analogs had done. But Mitchell needs to be understood as part of a larger trend, an unforeseen consequence of the conflict between the LDS Church and its ultra-conservatives during the early 90s. The appearance of Emmanuel David Isaiah is a dramatic sign of unresolved tension between Mormonism's past and present. The man in white robes who preached to the homeless just blocks from Temple Square is a product, partly it may well be, of mental illness, but also of an ongoing tug of war between what Mormonism once was and what it is trying to become.
When Elizabeth Smart returned home after 9 months after the control of Brian David Mitchell, her mother Lois knew exactly what the first order of business was: to undo Elizabeth's braids, to cut down that hair, to make her daughter look as before the abduction. I wonder if Lois Smart knew at that time that by cutting Elizabeth's braids, she was taking her daughter through one of the most meaningful rites of passage for fundamentalist girls who ran away from their homes. As the Smarts embarked in the task of distancing their daughter from her recent past, high-ranking employees of the LDS Church were working extra hours on a strategy to distance the church from alleged abductor Brian David Mitchell. It wasn't just the Mormon background of Mitchell that bothered them. It was also the fact that Mitchell was a polygamist. It took them less than 24 hours to come up with the statement that John Charles read. Reporters had a field day as they came up with profiles of Mitchell. From faith to fanatic delusion, wrote Carrie Moore for the Deseret News. Religious zeal is a common theme in broken minds, observed Christopher Smart for the Salt Lake Tribune. The Deseret News illustration was a montage that included not only pictures of Mitchell, but also pictures of Mark Hoffman and Tom Green. Deseret News reporter Carrie Moore accused Mitchell, among other things, of taking scriptural verses out of context, stringing them together, and using his revelations to command his first wife to accept the plural wives he was about to take. The article in the Tribune shows a picture of Christopher Fink, and the story reads like who's who of Utah's infamous religious past: Irvin LeBaron, John Singer, Adam Swapp, Dan and Ron Lafferty, Bruce Longo, Rachel David, Cody Judy. I'd like to propose today that the reason why we find Mitchell so repulsive is deeper than it seems. As the media bombarded us with stories of the deranged prophet, I was intrigued by the similarities between Mitchell and the one Mormon prophet no reporter dared to mention. Like Mitchell, Joseph Smith was a master of recontextualizing scriptures. He too received and wrote revelations. He too received a revelation instructing his first wife to receive his plural wives. On more than one occasion, he took a teenage girl into the woods and married her in a secret ceremony. Mitchell reportedly used a knife to take Elizabeth. Joseph Smith, in contrast, used the mere power of his own prophetic voice, a voice that was sharper than a two-edged sword. In this paper, I will not analyze Brian David Mitchell per se, but I will attempt to place him within a larger context. In order to prepare this presentation, I ask myself the following questions. How can we explain the personal gift of prophecy in an institution with a centralized outlet for worldwide revelations? How do we understand the process by which alternative Mormon prophets feel compelled to write the revelations they receive? And are these prophetic voices an aberration or simply a continuation of a tradition that started with Joseph Smith? One of the most amazing things that I found out as I prepared this paper is that even though we often talk about dissenters writing their prophecies, sometimes Mormons in the mainstream, both men and women, receive and write revelations too. Every obedient letter they say knows that you are not supposed to receive revelations unless they apply to your own sphere of stewardship. However, there are cases when saints in the mainstream feel compelled to write what they receive, and the contents are sometimes astonishing. Let me give you one example. In the mid-1970s, a young Mormon convert, who was at the time a BYU student, started to receive and write what he called the place of Jared. His revelations included, among other things, a description of the Jaredite priesthood and the temple rituals the Jaredites performed. The student had not at that time been through the temple. He was not a religious fanatic and had never been diagnosed as mentally ill. Some of his roommates, intrigued by the description of temple rituals that he had received, arranged an interview with Elder Paul H. Dunn. In the course of the interview, the student gave Elder Dunn all his writings. And even though Elder Dunn told the student he would be in touch, the student never heard from Elder Dunn again. Considering the LDS obsession with keeping records, I wonder how many other devoted Mormons' writings may be sitting today in the vaults of Little Cottonwood Canyon, to the extent that members believe that only the prophet has the right to receive church-wide revelations. These obscure LDS prophets will remain obscure. They will hide their writings, destroy them, share them only with a few confidants, or, like the BYU student, turn them over to a higher authority for assessment and stewardship. We will never hear of these writings. The writings we do hear about are, by the mere act of disclosure, a challenge to the institution. But even when these revelations do circulate, they are not necessarily easy to find. Alternative Mormon prophets typically share their writings with a small group of followers. Most circulate privately and are never published. Mitchell's own written revelations, the Book of Emmanuel, now seems stereotypical only because they ended up in the kind of sensational story that news reporters love to tell. But by no means does the Book of Emmanuel represent the tremendous diversity of alternative prophetic voices you can find in the Mormon tradition. Some Mormon prophets receive prophetic or apocalyptic revelations, but many do not. Some Mormon prophets receive revelations that tell them to restore or to start a new church, but many do not. Some Mormon prophets write revelations to condemn the apostate state of the church or its leaders, but many do not. In my opinion, automatic writing and automatic dictation could explain, perhaps, the way in which Joseph Smith received his revelation, and also the way in which so many other alternative prophets in the Mormon tradition received theirs. But how do these Mormon prophets describe the experience, their experience of receiving revelations for themselves? I will briefly examine three cases. The first comes from Antonio Feliz, who in the 1980s helped found a Mormon church for gays and lesbians. In his published biography, Feliz says that he felt an uncontrollable burst of energy that led him to sit down, take his pen, and begin to write. "To my servant Antonio," he wrote, "peace be unto your soul. You have been faithful in those principles which reach into eternity." Feliz never claimed to be the only true prophet on the face of the earth, but he did feel that he was channeling messages from God. Some 40 of his revelations are included in a collection called Hidden Treasures and Promises, published by the Restoration Church of Jesus Christ. Later, the Restoration Church rejected Feliz as a prophet, but they never rejected the revelations they had previously accepted. The sealed portion of the Brother of Jared is a poetic extension of the Book of Mormon. Some of you may remember 2 years ago when some members of the Brotherhood of Christ Church came to the Sensen Symposium to promote their book. The Brotherhood of Christ Church continues to be quite a mysterious community, and so is their prophet, Gokhar Harem III. Harem is a former member of the RLDS Church, known today as the Community of Christ. His method of revelation is similar to Joseph Smith's. It involves sacred tablets, a Urim and Thummim, and dictation. When I put the Urim and Thummim on and I begin to see, writes Harem, usually I begin to see starting in the middle of the top edge of the glory stone. He's referring to one of the tablets. And what is being seen is too profound for any human words, and it grows to fill up all that is in my view. I am usually not looking at the stones. It is not what I do with the Urim and Thummim. It is what the Urim and Thummim does with me. No matter where I look, I see. Technology has influenced the method by which Mormon prophets write and circulate their revelations. Joseph Smith, of course, used dictation or longhand, but some 20th century Mormon prophets have received revelations in front of a typewriter or a keyboard. In 1980, Franklin Lee Coleman received a revelation that he later described in the following terms. I, Franklin Lee Coleman, do testify that on the morning of December 4, 1980, while lying on an unmarked gravestone in Hazard Hill Cemetery in Waycross, Georgia, at about 2:30 a.m., the Lord spoke to me in tongues. Go to your typewriter, and I will write out what I want to say to all my creations through the means of a one-page advertisement in the Waycross Journal Herald. Notice in the following paragraph how Coleman describes the mechanics of receiving a revelation via typewriting. I went to the middle room of my mother's home and turned on my electric typewriter. As the Lord is my God, his fingers led it to write out by my fingers the following revelation. Coleman's revelations goes on describing the Free Will Mormon Church, which is described in terms of what I would call a nudist colony. But just like Felice and many other divergent Mormon prophets, Coleman did not see any clash between the Free Will Mormon Church and the Utah-based institution. There is no conflict between my new church and the LDS Church, the Lord told Coleman in his revelation. I choose to reveal myself in many ways that may seem mysterious at the present time, but will be clear in the future. Now, let me end up with a few personal observations. I have no compassion for Mitchell. I believe he is a monster. But at the same time, I have to accept the fact that Mitchell did not find his model in David Koresh, or in Marshall Applewhite, or in Jim Jones. He found his model in Joseph Smith. When a Mormon prophet rises from the mainstream, calls the establishment to repentance, and establishes a following, he or she is doing what Joseph Smith did 2 centuries ago. But with a prophetic claim comes an awesome responsibility to tell people how to live their lives. And we have learned by sad experience that the distinction between inspired counsel and abusive manipulation can be a blurry one. Just like Lois Smart, the day when she recovered her daughter, the LDS Church is highly invested in cutting down the brazen of Mormon polygamy, in removing the veil and robes of the 19th century cult, in replacing them with a contemporary dress that screams, I am mainstream. But no matter how much we distance ourselves from polygamy and from the excesses of charismatic figures, the story of Mitchell is scary for us because it points to certain prophetic impulses that lie within our tradition. These impulses do not reside in our hairdo, in our outfit, not even in our garments. They are embedded in our flesh and bones, in our brain, and in our collective memory. Whether we choose to reject them, to embrace them, or to ignore them, the charismatic prophetic impulses of Mormonism help explain who we are and how we got here, and will affect whatever it is that we are about to become.
I'm going to focus on crime and on these kinds of crimes. It seems to me that in the past about 35 years, there has been a series of, not a very big series, but a series of high-profile crimes like Mitchell and Elizabeth Smart, crimes that are arguably connected to Mormonism and crimes that make public relations problems for the Mormon Church. I want to do two things with this talk of crime. I want to make one preliminary point, and I've got two things. One preliminary point is, if you think how you want to think about fundamental Mormonism, if you think how you want to think about people who receive revelations or who write books or who live homeless, at least the way that I want to think about them, that's their business so long as they obey the law. I don't believe in any of that stuff. They can do as they please. I'll do as I please. That's what we do here in America. We call it freedom of religion. However, there's this series of crimes, and that isn't just them doing what they want to do. That affects other people very negatively, and that's a matter of concern. Now, I want to make two points. First, I want to say that I want to look roughly at Mormons and violence and contemporary Mormons and violence, violent crime. And secondly, I want to talk a little bit about this series of highly publicized Mormon-connected violent crimes. First, let's look at Mormons and violence. So far as I know, I don't know of any statistics that say that measure crimes by Mormons and crimes by other religions. The FBI that keeps criminal statistics, or the State Bureau of Criminal Identification that keeps criminal statistics, none of these keep statistics by religion. So I don't know of any direct statistics. So I'm going to use some indirect statistics. What I'm going to do is compare violent crime rates in Utah, which is about 70% Mormon, to violent crime rates in America, which is about 2% Mormon. In Utah, you are about two-fifths as likely to be murdered as you are in the average American place. That is, for every 100,000 Utahns, there are about 2.1 murders per year. For every 100,000 Americans, there are about 5.7 murders per year. Those are 1999 statistics, which were the last I could find comparing them both. I think a good researcher could find something up to 2001, but I couldn't. That kind of relationship, that kind of ratio, has operated since about 1960 when people began comparing this. It fluctuates a little from year to year. You are about half as likely in Utah to be the victim of an aggravated assault, about one-third as likely to be the victim of an armed robbery, about 15% more likely to be the victim of a rape. Utah rape rates are about 15% higher than the national average. Overall, Utah violent crime rates are about half the national average, a little bit above half the average national violent crime rates. I take it that what I would conclude from this is that, as a matter of fact, if you look at conduct, Mormons are probably a little less violent than other Americans, a little less likely to commit violent crimes. And that's gone on for, as I said, 40 years. Now, all these numbers with respect to Utah are, while they, to my mind, they look pretty good, they are better than they look. Why is that? Why are they better than they look? Who commits violent crimes? Young men commit violent crimes. By the time you get to be my age, you're fairly safe. Utah has a high birth rate. It has the youngest population in America, and it has a disproportionately large percentage of young men in its population. If our young men committed violent crimes at the national average, our violent crime rate would be 2 to 3 times what it is. It would be considerably higher. Now, I've only spoken of violent crime. Our overall crime rate, if you include burglary, car theft, all of the things that the FBI counts, is generally speaking slightly higher than the national average. but we have roughly speaking, fewer murders, a few more burglaries. And both of them are less than you would expect given our demographic shape, given the number of young men we have. I conclude from this that if you look at the practice of Mormons over the past 40 years or so, while we've been keeping these numbers, Mormons are somewhat less inclined to be violent than other Americans overall. Though I admit the statistics aren't entirely persuasive. They sort of persuade me. Nonetheless, given that Mormons are somewhat less inclined to be violent, there has been, over the past 3 decades or a little more, a series of high-profile crimes that are connected to Mormonism, somehow in the way that, say, Mitchell Barzee are connected to Mormonism, though not all in exactly that way. But there is an indirect connection, and I'm going to look at 5 of these very briefly. There's Mitchell Barzee, that was the latest one, but let's start with the first one. Irvel LeBaron is the first one that I think of. He died in the Utah State Prison after some of his disciples murdered a Rulon Allred in an intra-polygamous dispute. There are books that say, and evidently they are right, that LeBaron and his followers murdered dozens, literally dozens of people, most of them in Mexico, some of them in Texas, and they did this. Irvel LeBaron received revelations, and that's how, normally he would receive a revelation and then his followers would go kill somebody. There was Singer and Swap. John Singer was a polygamist who married a woman in polygamy who had kids. She was divorced. The court said that they had to give up the kids. The father got custody. Singer refused to give up the kids. He had a series of run-ins with lawmen, and they ended up shooting him. Then a member of his family, I think it's his son-in-law, Adam Swap, he and Vicki Singer, who had been one of John Singer's wives up in Marion, Utah, they got in a dispute with Lee. Did a bunch of forgeries. Then he blew up 2 people with a bomb, and you all know the story of Mark Hoffman. Ron and Dan Lafferty, who have been in the news very much lately, are in prison. They, on July 24th, 1984, they murdered their sister-in-law, Brenda Lafferty, and her little daughter, Erica, who was less than 2, about 1. They slit her throat. And they are in prison, Ron, under a death sentence. Now, there are others. They mentioned some in their papers that you could count. There was recently, I mean in the 80s, a made-for-TV movie called Standoff at Altamont about a person who went a little crazy and killed a nurse out of Altamont Hospital, and it had religious overtones. And there are others, but I'm going to look at those 5 because they're the strongest. Now, in the paper in this seminar, four things were cited: health, revelation, politics, and withdrawal. Lafferty was not much of a withdrawer, was not much of a separationist. He lived in society, but their father was a chiropractor, and they believed very much in alternative medicine, and they had quasi-religious feelings against medicine. Dan Lafferty ran for sheriff as an ultra-conservative of Utah County and was not elected in Utah County. So on everything but perhaps withdrawal, you would say yes, they fit the pattern exactly. LeBaron, maybe on everything, they withdrew. They lived down in Mexico. They were conservative politicians. Lafferty wrote out lots of revelations, and his followers carried them out. I don't know the Lafferty views on health. They were not. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't believe in traditional medicine or in conventional medicine, but I don't know that. The only one of all those who was actually a member of the LDS Church was Mark Hoffman, and he doesn't fit on anything else. He was simply semi-evil man who wanted money, murdered, forged and murdered. And he was the only actual member of the LDS Church out of those. They've talked about Mitchell who fit the pattern. What would I conclude from this? I want to make two other points before the conclusion. First, as near as I can tell, this sort of stuff didn't happen before Herval LeBaron. There was violence back in the 19th century, but in the 20th century, up until 1970 or the late 1960s, there simply wasn't this kind of highly publicized violent crime in the Mormon tradition, nearly as I can tell. Maybe some of you know of some. I don't know of any. It seemed to begin then, and I don't know why, except a lot of crime went up in the 60s. But other than that, I don't know why that happened. While it's connected to the Mormon tradition, I want to make the conclusion that Mormons are on the whole not very violent. That Mormons, the Mormon Church, so far as it can, rejects violence and rejects criminal violence, and evidently does so fairly effectively. So while I think you can point to tradition and point to people who in this fundamentalist tradition have committed crimes, on the whole, it seems to me that it's probably wrong to blame the fundamentalist tradition for the crimes, and it seems to me wrong to blame the LDS tradition as a whole for the crimes.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes for questions and answers, and what I would like to do is, when I call you, if you could come up here and speak into the microphone, that would be best, so we can have your questions on tape and I don't have to take the repeating the question every time. You had a question? Would you like to come up here? And if you could say your name, that would be great.
I'm Colleen McDaniel, and I have a question and an addition. It seems to me that there's a fifth character that no one's really discussed, and that's the issue of gender. And it seems to be important, especially to keep in mind this notion of the 15% increase in Utah over the general rape population. And so I guess the question I have is perhaps addressed initially, which is I understand the 4 points, but the kidnapping of the young girl seems somehow not to fit into any of the categories. And so could gender, which connects with rape and obviously polygamy, sexuality, women, men, patriarchy, couldn't this also be a category that needs to be considered in one way? And the same thing with Joseph Smith, whether or not that's, no one's really talked about the male-female relationships and all of this.
Yes, actually, as I was preparing my handout, I was struck by the fact that the only woman on that handout is Betty Eady, who significantly is New Age. And so, yes, I think there is this definite correlation between the fact that in the Mormon tradition, it's men who receive revelation. It's men who have prophetic authority. I think that's what you're seeing there. In regards to the issue of kidnapping the girl, one thing I had to omit from my paper for the sake of time is that actually there are certain precedents for that. There is a certain interest in young girls among ultra-conservatives. Jim Harmston has been accused of preying on teenage girls. I don't know if the accusations are true, but the accusations have come up. Sterling Allen of the American Study Group has said that at one point in his life he considered running off with a 14-year-old girl. And Bo Greitz was once arrested on charges of kidnapping, though in that case it wasn't an issue of a girl being involved. But there is this history of kidnapping charges and interest in young girls that emerges, which I suspect probably has something to do with the fact that, you know, 19th century Mormonism, Reformation period, lots of young girls getting married off. You know, that's probably where that originates.
Okay. Yes.
My name is Kurt Gillespie. Mr. Decker, I direct this mostly to you. You probably have the most knowledge on it. There's reports in the Tribune were reported initially. They haven't been much followed. I'm from California. I look on the websites of the Deseret News and the Tribune every day almost. The Tribune reported that Mitchell had been either a second counselor to a bishopric or stake presidency. I wonder why there hasn't been more reports from people in that congregation or the people who appointed him there, whether they made a mistake or whether they shared some of his thoughts or things like that. And my second question would be on the Larry King piece that was done a while back, where the stepdaughter said that she was molested by Mitchell and that said he was crazy like a fox, that he was going to know one day he'd be caught for his crimes against other girls and women, and that he said, well, no one's going to believe you because you were smoking, and I'm going to tell your mom you were smoking, and that's why you're making up these accusations that I attacked you. And so he had kind of this thing planned that somebody would be caught, maybe go to a mental hospital, or just would play the fundamentalist card, hoping there'd be someone on the jury that would believe him, and you get a hung jury and, you know, not face the consequences. Could you address those two issues?
Can't address them very well. I don't know, is the answer. Mitchell was in Southern California. I had never heard that he was in an ecclesiastical position. Lee Benson of the Deseret News went down and asked around San Diego, where he was a homeless person down there and known as a homeless person who preached. He was doubtless somewhat of a predator, and he clearly planned other abductions and other rapes of young women. I don't know that they've got any yet that he actually carried out. I don't think he's been charged with any, or any the police think they've got evidence of any. Best I can do.
Let me follow up to that. My understanding of the news reports is that Mitchell was a high counselor here in Utah at some point. He was a high counselor, stake high counselor. He was also a temple worker, which many of you have probably heard the famous story about how he played Lucifer really well. As for the allegations of... Oh, the story is that he boasts that he was playing Lucifer in the temple ceremony, and he was so good at it that they asked him to tone it down. They said he was the best Lucifer they'd ever seen. As for the charges of sexual abuse, yes, he's been charged with physical and sexual abuse in both of his previous two marriages, as well as, you know, Wanda Barzee's stepdaughter has also accused him of that. So there does seem to be a history of that.
Anyone else with questions? No, you guys have spoken longer. Come on up.
Kent Olson with a question for Rod Decker. You indicated that there didn't seem to be a fundamentalist or mainstream Mormon motivation necessarily between these five examples you cited, but do you find some common threads here that might explain their bizarre and criminal actions?
I guess the point is that in any population you're going to have some bizarre and criminal actions. In the Mormon population, as nearly as I can tell, you have somewhat fewer criminal actions. We certainly have our share of bizarre actions. But there's a distinction between bizarre and criminal actions. And as near as I can tell, the Mormons have fewer than their share of violent crimes. Rapes 15% higher. Now, remember that our population of young women and young men is considerably higher. And you would expect a little more rape from that. So we do have a higher rape rate.
We have a
relatively high teenage suicide rate. And I think that isn't just that we have a lot of teenagers, even compared to the number of teenagers. We have a relatively high teenage suicide rate. I don't know if that's related to Mormonism or if it isn't. And I haven't looked at teenage suicide except just at the numbers. Violent crime, we have a little less. Now, you mentioned gender, and while I'm here, I want to make one brief point about that. In general, women commit a lot fewer violent crimes than men do. Maybe about one woman to ten offenders in violent crimes. So it should not surprise us that many of the offenders in high-profile Mormon crimes are men, as opposed to women. Most offenders in violent crimes are men, as opposed to women. Yes, certainly there is a gender. Certainly, in the Mormon tradition, there is a strain where men act, and men act publicly more than women act. That's the tradition, and that may have something to do with these sorts of things. But it would seem to me to be explicable, at least in part, just that everywhere men commit more violent crimes than women.
Well, for the last 15 years, I've been studying the RLDS splinter groups, and there's been dozens and dozens and dozens of local groups. There's only two that I would consider cult-like, and they both follow the characteristics that you two have mentioned, the separation from the world, the nostalgia for the good old days when we were in contact with God regularly. And both of them clearly were very much absorbed in the Joseph Smith canon rather than the Bible, well, rather than the New Testament. You almost never hear them quote the New Testament, but always Isaiah or the Book of Mormon or the Doctrine and Covenants. So anyway, my studies would tend to confirm the kind of conclusions you're coming to.
Anyone else have a question?
Maybe I would make a comment. William, I understand that you were involved in testifying for a case in the RLDS Church that is similar to these cases that we have been discussing in the Mormon. Would you like to talk? I think we have 2 minutes if you want to make a comment about it.
Yeah, Jeff Lundgren was a tour guide of the Kirtland Temple from 1984 to 87, and was finally forced out of the temple by a stake president who recognized him as kind of strange. But Jeff had a strong following among fundamentalist RLDS in the Kirtland area, but when he was removed as a temple tour guide, he gathered a group of followers south of town, or south of the temple, about 3 miles, and began to plan to reclaim the temple, which is now in the evil hands of the RLDS leaders. And he planned to kill the stake president and his family of five, and the stake bishop and his wife, and several other RLDS people near the temple to cleanse the vineyard around the house of the Lord. But that got scotched when one of his disciples fled and told the police. And so instead, then Jeff, a year later, killed a family of five within his group, because he was determined that, based on some Book of Mormon passages especially, that, you know, repent or be destroyed. And if we develop a community that repents of all their sins, then Christ will come and Zion will be established. So he killed the Avery family because he was convinced that they would never repent, and then, you know, they're part of his group, so they needed to be can't remember the word he used now, but anyway, they needed to be destroyed. So he killed this family of five in 1989, and then fled to the wilderness of West Virginia, the national forest, to wait for Christ's return. But Christ never showed up. As far as I know, anyway.
He's still under this, but it's in Ohio.
Yes, he's
in
Ohio. And I know he's in prison.
I think we still have another minute if there's any other comments or questions. I'd at least like to thank the panel for being here and representing this position. And thank the audience. Thank you.